to lead us in questions, and after that I will take questions from the members.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to yourself, honourable members, the minister, the visitors and colleagues. Minister, your submission today, it would appear to me that you've had to peruse a number of what I'll refer to as source documents to assist you to recollect the events as articulated in the submission. Would that be a fair observation?
Yes, it is a fair observation. And as I say at the beginning, some of the documents were not available to me at the time of presenting myself, and so I'm still awaiting them to go through them. So if there are any gaps, I will still have to refer to those. And as I said, I'm prepared to submit any questions I may not be able to answer today in writing to the committee.
Any reason you are aware of why the source documents you're already in possession of, that you'd already utilized to prepare the submission, could not be made available to the committee?
I indicated at the beginning of my presentation that some of the documents were classified as confidential, and therefore should they be declassified, then we can make them available.
I will, Chair, ask the committee permission for such documentation to be declassified and made available to the committee, with your permission. Minister, then let's move to the appointment of board members. In pages 2 of your submission, and I think the last page of your submission, dealing with conclusions, you express some regret around the appointments that were made, for they have proven not to be what they had been intended to be. Is that correct?
Yes. Should I keep this on? Yes, I do.
What is it then? Because clearly that suggests that the systems that were in place were not effective enough to stop rogue elements infiltrating the system. What is it that has to be done to improve the system, in your view?
I think we need greater cooperation. You see, there are difficulties that we are going to face, even going forward, because the appointment of boards becomes sensitive information. And even when you appoint them, you try to keep the information as confidential as possible and to do it as quickly as possible so that it doesn't leak. Because there have been many instances where such information has leaked, and it undermines serving members and undermines those who are to be appointed. But we do need to find an alignment that allows the members to be appointed, the candidates to be appointed, to be vetted properly. Unfortunately, when you create a database for the appointment of board members, you can't vet them prior to the need to appoint them. It's only at the time when you have to appoint them that you need to do vetting. And so I think the improvement that is required between the shareholder representatives and state security is the vetting of board members prior to the processes being taken to cabinet. Because as the name says before, a minister, as the minister takes the names to cabinet, they have no way of knowing besides the information presented, such as the CVs, the resumes, the qualifications, the approvals by the South African Qualifications Authority and all of that, they have no way of knowing, for example, a person's associates, who the person meets with and interacts with beyond the call of duty and beyond the documents submitted. And that creates loopholes in the system, which may in the future turn out to undermine what was initially intended as a genuine process.
Whilst still on the appointment of board members, your submission paints a picture of you having looked at the people's qualifications, their skills and set, and the required skills in the organization that they were to be appointed to. This matter does not relate to your tenure at public enterprises. I'm going to ask it though, because you were a member of cabinet when this incident took place, or when this decision was made. Sometime last year, Mr. Zethemba Khoza appeared before the committee. At the time, he was an acting chairperson of the ESCOM board. At that stage, if people didn't have an idea of the wrongs happening at ESCOM, at least there were certain allegations that had come to the fore. And in my assessment, he had performed very badly under oath. But most importantly, he had given himself and his board, in terms of performance, a 3 out of 10. Which is, by his own admission, a dismal performance of a board, which was an interim board. But this appointment, or his appointment, together with the interim board members, were conferred by cabinet subsequent to his appearance yet before this committee. Were you part and parcel of the cabinet meeting that approved this appointment?
Yes, I was in December last year. I was in that meeting.
At that stage, you were Minister of Finance, correct?
Yes.
What was your assessment of the allegations of wrongdoings on the economy of the country? Around these allegations of state capture?
You know, the difficulty with the question is that it seeks my personal opinion outside of the cabinet collective. But obviously, I had a dim view of the proposal that was presented before us. The initial suggestion was that members be added, there were new appointments that were being made into the board, and that Mr. Khoza should be retained as an acting chair until the AGM, which apparently was scheduled for early this year. It eventually took place at some point early this year. Our view was that that should not have been done. There was a debate around that matter, that someone else should be considered as chairperson of the board, in spite of the fact that the appointments were being made subject to an impending AGM. But ultimately, upon discussion, it was felt that to introduce someone else who is new into the picture at the present moment would subject them to a package which they did not intend to carry. And so I personally had a view that we needed to appoint somebody altogether new as chairman of the board, and that was finally realized in February, in January this year, when a new board was appointed and a new chairman was appointed, and I had made my views public in regard to the agency for changes on the board of Eskom. And so, regardless of that oversight in December, but the cabinet subsequently corrected the problem and a new board was appointed with a new, very credible chairperson.
Mr. Siyabonga Masangu, what was the relationship between the minister and him, and the circumstances surrounding him being the advisor to the minister? And can we get clarity, what role was he playing to the minister?
Mr. Masangu was a legal advisor to the minister, and as is expected, special advisors are not part of the department, even though they are governed by the public service legislation. But they are not part of the department. Their role is solely to advise the minister on aspects that relate to the minister's work. Now, obviously, the minister would not prescribe what do people do outside their working hours. And in some instances, they will not themselves inform the minister or report to the minister what they are doing. It is expected that if they should get into any business activities, they should seek the minister's express permission. They should write to inform the minister. But in the instances that doesn't happen, the minister has no way of knowing that it is taking place.
I'm sure the minister would agree that if the allegations are proven to be correct of him calling Mr. Damas to his office, introducing him to people who want coal contracts, that would be something that inadvertently brings the office of the minister into disrepute. What is your view on that,
Minister? That's absolutely correct. Let me start by saying, in relation to the issues that were in discussion, I had no formal request or formal submission from Eskom that they needed any additional coal at Letabo Power Station. I myself had visited Letabo Power Station, I think, once or twice in my official capacity as the minister, and neither Eskom nor the department's energy and broadband enterprises branch had brought to my attention any idea that Letabo needed additional coal. But secondly, Eskom, much as I, as a minister, would have preferred that Coal 3 be built by Eskom, I know at the time that was my view, that Coal 3 must be allocated to Eskom, but there was no decision in cabinet, whether at the PICC, the Presidential Infrastructure Coordinating Commission, or cabinet itself, that Coal 3 would be allocated either to Eskom or as an IPP. So there was no decision on the matter. I don't think that bringing Brian into that conversation or bringing Mr. Damas into that conversation was fair to him, because ultimately the decision didn't rest with him. It would rest with the ministers responsible at a policy level, and Eskom would only become involved once the decision has been made with regard to where Coal 3, how Coal 3 is going to be provided and where that new power station is going to be built. And obviously in making that consideration, we would also look at what would be the cost benefits of building Coal 3, whether in the Free State or in KZN or anywhere else outside the main coal supply provinces in the country.
On learning of Mr. Dhamma's testimony before the committee and its impact on the minister at some point called Mr. Masangu just to find out the circumstances or the accuracy of the allegations that were made against him.
No, I haven't had a discussion with him as I felt that the issue did not require me. I had not participated in it. Mr. Dames had not informed me about it. And in any way, none of those issues materialized because Mr. Dames ensured that they did not materialize. So I did not feel the need to call him and discuss this with him.
Notwithstanding that your reputation was subjected to scrutiny as a result of his conduct?
No.
Let's move to the third issue, the new logo coal, the Anglo New Largo Coal Sirius. Did you have any discussions about this matter with the then GCE, Mr. Dames?
New Largo Coal, I'm not particularly aware. I would like to be finished with the details of that.
This is the mine that was going to provide coal to Kusile Power Station. And the information that I have is that Anglo had entered into discussions with Eskom to build a mine or to have a mine that would provide coal to Kusile. That does not ring a bell.
Look, the discussions with regard to specific coal contracts of Eskom, I did not involve myself in those. I involved myself in a broader policy discussion with Eskom, which was predicated on what we were drafting as the emerging miners strategy, which we started engaging on, I think if I'm not mistaken, around 2012. And we were saying by 2018 we would like the 50% plus one of Eskom's coal supply to be provided to black coal miners. I therefore had that discussion with Eskom. We had several meetings with the board of Eskom. The strategy itself was being drafted by Eskom and spearheaded by the board of Eskom, including the executive directors. We had two consultative sessions with emerging coal miners at which we had specific discussions around these issues. I had a dinner with Mr. Mark Kutifani in Johannesburg, where the Eskom CE was also present and some of my policy advisors back then. At this meeting, we had a broader discussion. Mr. Kutifani asked me a few questions. One, whether there was a change in the government's mining charter, to which I responded, no, the mining charter is not within my purview. I cannot change it. I can only comment about Eskom's coal supplies. And he asked whether is government now shifting its view to take a view that the coal supplies to Eskom must be moved to black hands. I said, yes, we would like to do that. It's part of the vision that I have spearheaded since my arrival as Minister of Public Enterprises. And thirdly, he then said, what then happens to their coal contracts? I said, that is a matter that has to be discussed between Eskom and its various suppliers. Obviously, you don't expect Eskom to simply pack and go on existing contracts. They would need to honor existing contracts, but in my view, there was a possibility that we should move in this direction. And he offered, at the end of that discussion, endless full cooperation with us in that direction, to the extent that we were not going to result in abandoning illegally or unlawfully of the existing contract that Eskom has. I think I'll continue to hold the view that the evergreen contracts are a problem. Much as I'm no longer the Minister of Finance or the Minister of Public Enterprises, but in my capacity as an activist in South Africa, I still hold the view that the evergreen contracts, be it at Eskom or in the audit environment or any other industrial sector in South Africa, are a problem. There is a need for a change of policy that is going to result in the empowerment of black people. And I think that state-owned companies, as major procurers of services and other goods, must use their procurement muscle to spearhead change among their customers and suppliers so that black people, women, and young people could have space in that environment. And that's why, as Minister of Public Enterprises, I was very vocal on issues of transformation, be it of auditors of the 8 state-owned companies in my portfolio, or the legal and other professional services, and even of other services and goods that were being procured by state-owned companies.
Minister, what's on this issue of transformation? There appears to be an outcry even to date from black immersion miners to access business from Eskom in particular. What programs did you put in place at your time or see to it that the board would put in place to advance the policy positions you've just espoused?
Thank you. I think the first one I've spoken about is the emerging miners strategy, which eventually was not implemented. And I think that one of the things we were trying to do at the time was to move, we presented a business case in terms of which Alexco would diversify from diamond mining solely to also become a coal miner and supplier to Eskom, and we would use Alexco as the basis to spearhead this emerging miners strategy and bring on board many emerging miners. So the emerging miners strategy was the biggest plan we were working on, and I think had it materialized, it would have resulted in billions of rand by now being managed by black coal miners. The second one related to audit firms. We took a very firm view in that regard that black auditors must be given space to audit the state-owned companies. Transnet was the first to move in towards that direction when they appointed Sizwe Ntsaluba Koboto, making them the fifth biggest audit firm in South Africa, although still significantly smaller than the Big Four. They also provided their internal audit work to Sigela Klabisa, which also allowed Sigela Klabisa to grow. They intended to provide such a contract to also, Eskom also wanted to do the same thing, but when National Treasury changed the preferential procurement rules, that then took away the transformation that would have taken place there. But the other state-owned companies, including South African Airways, Dinel, Alexco itself and others, had given their audit services to black firms. Other black professional service providers also got space during the time. I had two consultations with the advertising agencies about the opportunity they wanted to be provided by state-owned companies. But we also, in the course of that, focused on the enterprise hub development at Eskom and Transnet in particular, the result of which was the provision of an oil supply contract of about 5.1 billion rand to a black female in Limpopo province. So there's a number of transformation initiatives that we undertook, and then obviously one of the things that we were looking at is how do we strategically position Transnet Engineering not only as a supplier of rolling stock, as a maintainer and overhauler and provider of rolling stock to Transnet, but to also provide leverage for emerging black industrialists in that space to also become suppliers to Transnet and even to Eskom. So we were looking at a number of initiatives during the time.
What is the minister's view on non-executive directors' involvement in procurement within the boards of SOEs?
My understanding is that the non-executive directors do not become directly involved, because this is an operational matter, and I think they have a responsibility as non-executive directors and the board as a whole. They have a responsibility to shield the executives from interference into operations. I think they should not get involved. Where they get involved as the board is in receiving the reports, so that they are able to process those reports and provide them to the shareholder representative, especially when you are talking about huge contracts. My own view was that the Transnet fleet locomotive contract, as well as PRASA, because they were taking place concurrently, I held the view back then, as I do now, that those contracts should have been used to catalyze the industrialization of the South African economy, to bring on board black suppliers of various components of these state-owned companies, to ensure that we establish, if not international original equipment manufacturing capabilities in South Africa, but at least an original equipment manufacturing capability of sorts that would enable the country to target markets and provide these services to markets that are nearby us. And so I think that the boards of these state-owned companies, instead of involving themselves into operations, they need to pay attention to the more strategic policy matters that assist to enhance the policy directive of the country.
I think I share that view of yours, Minister. But what I'm struggling to find out is who introduced this concept that board members should now get involved in operational matters such as procurement. And when, if you know?
I don't know who introduced it. I don't know also when it came about, because to my understanding, even the establishment of the procurement subcommittee at the board of Transnet was a decision which was taken prior to my arrival. And the board sought through that to manage the reports and to be able to assist the executives in implementing their decisions. My understanding is that even when it came to the 1064, the locomotives, the entire process of the procurement was led by the CEO, and he reported to the board. But insofar as the boards themselves are concerned, they ought not to involve themselves in the procurement processes. It undermines their role as non-executive directors, but it also undermines the role of the executive directors. For example, I, as a minister, not only do I not involve myself in the procurement of my department, I also don't know who are the members of the bid evaluation committees, bid adjudication committees. I don't involve myself in those things. I don't know who are the members of those committees. And I don't even ask for reports of such. I provide policy direction to the department, and where the department sources its services is the function of the accounting officer. Once I get involved, I then confuse the roles of the accounting and the executive officer, and much as the accounting officer would be shielded from accountability, from accounting by this decision, but I compromise the role of the executive of authority in providing leadership to the department.
Minister, and I'm going to ask you in the context of your previous role as the former Minister of Finance. The reason for this question is people tend to appear before this committee and say, yeah, but these are mere allegations, they have not been proven in a court of law, which to a large extent is true. But the damage done already to the economy is not waiting for people to be proven guilty in a court of law. Can you give us a kind of a view or sense of what this damage of allegations of state capture have done to the economy of this country?
I think the most practical example, I mean, I've heard people guesstimating about what has been the cost to the economy, counting it in billions, and I think they're absolutely correct. But if you look at the performance of the South African economy between last year, December, and now, and how we were able during the course of the year to climb back up to the 1.3% growth target projection we had set ourselves in the budget of 2017, you would see the slowing down of the economy in 2017 as the allegations of corruption and state capture were prevalent. And come December 2017, especially following the political certainty provided by the ruling party's national conference and the high expectation among investors that certain issues are going to begin to be addressed relating to corruption and state capture, you saw the rand-dollar exchange, our own domestic currency strengthening against the dollar. You saw the appetite in South African stock at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange growing, especially among both domestic and international investors. And you saw the bond yields being reduced so that the economy stood a much better chance. And so as we began this year and action began to be taken on the board of Eskom, on the board of SAA last year, on the imminent changes to the board of DINEL, the decisive action we took to stop the DINEL Asia contract and ensure that the DINEL as a company gets out of the court case against the National Treasury. There was a positive sentiment that has resulted, I think, in the first quarter of the year in very high economic activity, the rand strengthening right up to up until it breached that psychological 12 rand to the dollar mark. And so there is a very high cost to corruption and allegations of state capture, and there is very high benefit to action being taken against those issues. And that's why it's important that the country, not only for public perception, international investor perception, but for our own good as a country, we should be seen to be taking drastic measures in this regard.
The second last question from me, Minister, is because you've been part and parcel of Cabinet, and this question I pose in your capacity as a member of Cabinet. When Cabinet appoints a ministerial committee, for instance, to look at the employment or re-employment of Mr. Molefe at Eskom, and officials and board members within Eskom refuses to share documents with the shareholder representative, they refuse to share documents with the ministerial committee established by Cabinet. When we see a board that stands guard, when 30 million leaves Eskom to go to a pension fund, and there's no accountability, when officials are facing, I mean, you were quoted in the media as asking some of these officials to leave Eskom. And when the country looks up to Cabinet for leadership, what message do these kinds of behaviors send to men and women in this country that look up to Cabinet for leadership?
I think in all sincerity, we should have been a bit more decisive on the issue. I think we shouldn't have allowed the previous board, even in the first instance, to take that decision. And the penalty for that decision should have, from the outset, been decisive and severe on the board, because it went a long way towards undermining the integrity of government and Cabinet in particular. I think we have taken the actions now with all the people implicated having been removed. And that's in part why we decided that we should appoint an acting CEO at Eskom from outside Eskom itself. Not that it's a vote of no confidence on current serving members of the executive of Eskom, but it's also to, you know, provide them with a bit of breathing space, because they would have worked with all the people involved, and so we want somebody who is who has not been part of the processes leading up to now to come and assist the company in moving forward, and so there has been severe impact. I think the indecisiveness has cost us a great deal. I held the view that if whenever I was asked what keeps me awake at night, I used to say it was Eskom, because I understood the risk of cross default should Eskom fail to pay its lenders, and should lenders call in their loans, because the guarantee to Eskom is the largest, and Eskom's debt is quite huge, and if it failed to pay, the state would have to step in, and the cost to the economy would have been severe. So we had been indecisive quite painfully, and the risk was enormous, and I think one is happy that there is progress, there is decisive action going forward, and that risk that is Eskom to the economy is going to be minimized. And the same applies to all other state-owned companies. I think the view we should take is that we will not allow malicious action activities of the nature that we saw last year to recur. Unfortunately, the lesson can only be learned after enormous cost to the economy, but nonetheless, the lesson has been learned.
My last area relates to the acquisition of the 1064 locomotives. At the time you approved the business case, the cost associated was around about 38.6 billion. There's a testimony before the committee that the cost escalated to around about or in excess of 50 billion. Was this ever brought to your attention, Minister, and if so, what were the reasons that were furnished to you?
As I indicate in my presentation, I raised this issue with the board of Transnet on several occasions, that the delays with the 1064 acquisition was severe to the economy and to the CAPEX itself. And I said to the board they need to expedite the decisions, but not in such a manner as they would, one, result in bad contracts being entered into, two, in undermining the policy, the transformation objectives of the country. But it seemed that you had a number of problems at Eskom. One of those was just in how they managed, at state-owned companies as a whole. And Eskom was one case where the build program was delayed so much that the cost overruns escalated severely. There was no proper management of the contract. The same would apply at Transnet. The Durban to Johannesburg National Multi-Product Pipeline got delayed, and it seemed again the problem was project management and the management of the contract, and now came to this. I also intervened with the board of SAA and said, you can't procure, you can't buy a new fleet at SAA without answering the question how you want that procurement to address localization, the offsets, the building of local capabilities. And so there seemed to be this problem across the SOEs, not only at the time when the contract has been entered into, but even prior to the contract being entered into. I stated very clearly in my response to them that there are these four conditions that I want you to satisfy me on so that I can give you a Section 54 approval that you are requiring from me to go ahead with the procurement. But the delays were, that year-long delays had that effect of resulting not only in the increase in the cost of the locomotives, but they now had to undertake another procurement of 4 billion rand in order to procure 100 coal locomotives that were going to fill the gap created by the delay. All of this would have been unwarranted had they immediately, because once the market demand strategy was adopted, they should have established these committees, set very clear timelines, complied with the timelines, ensured that they meet the targets which have been set, so that we don't experience any cost overruns.
Chair, that was my last question, but I know my earlier request had been denied. Can I just ask the committee that perhaps at the end I might have one or two issues. Can I be allowed an opportunity at the end? Thanks.
Thank you, Advocate Vanara. I will allow you that chance. It is up to me now to give you that chance. I'm not going to ask the members. Honorable Tsedi, Honorable Mazone, Honorable Swart, Honorable Gamini, Honorable Luyenge, Honorable Shivambo, Honorable Nganga Tabash.
Morning, Honorable Minister. You were the Minister of Public Enterprises between November 2010 and May 2014, am I right? Yeah, November 2010 and May 2014. Okay. In your presentation, you indicated that ministers are not involved in procurement processes, only in certain large tenders which require PFMA approval. Can you qualify that statement? Because to me, that statement seems a bit vague and it's subject to misinterpretation.
Thank you. It basically means the minister does not get involved in tenders. That's done by the SOC, the respective SOC. But when certain contracts are of the materiality threshold that is stipulated as requiring only Section 54 approval, what the SOC would do prior to undertaking the procurement and the bidding and so on, they would then write to the minister and inform the minister, present the business case and inform the minister of the conditions of the procurement, what it would cost, and all the processes that would be required. Then the minister approves, in principle, approves the procurement. By the time the minister, as the minister approves the Section 54, they don't know who has put the bids. They don't know the process. All of those processes have not been undertaken. So you are actually not involved. You are, as I say, approving the procurement in principle and setting out the conditions that you would want to be met. As I indicated in my response to Advocate Vanara, that you then say, meet the following conditions. Is there localization? Is there empowerment? Are there any offsets? Are there any transformation targets that are to be met with this? And what would be the role, for example, in the case of the 1064 of Transnet, what would be the role of Transnet Engineering? Because you can't have such a massive capability. And I still believe we are not using the capability of Transnet Engineering as well as we could. What would be the role of Transnet Engineering in regard to this procurement? How do we use Transnet Engineering to leverage for black empowerment and the involvement of local suppliers? So you set those broad parameters and you say to them, go ahead then, so that when they come back to have concluded the process, they then say to you, Minister, we have met all the conditions. It also enables the minister, acting on behalf of the country, to also penalize the company should, at the end of the day, the final procurement contract not meet the conditions which have been set.
In the case of what happened in ESCO, will you say that the SOC was, people who were responsible for procurement processes were well aware of all these processes that you outlined? Now, I'll prefer you to be very brief so that I can do justice to the rest of the issues.
In relation to what happened at ESCOM?
In relation to, as I've indicated, there are quite a number of tenders that have been awarded. There are quite a number of witnesses who came before the committee here who alleged that certain tenders were
awarded to people who were not supposed to get them, your trillion is all of them. Will you, in the light of what happened, say the company was aware of the process that you outlined?
Much as I have not perused the ESCOM documents, because all of these trillion, Tegeta, and the other one, they happened after I had left public enterprises. I have not had opportunity to peruse the documents, except, of course, in relation to the forensic audit. I called for, as Minister of Finance, on Tegeta, having received the report that was commissioned by the OCPO at National Treasury. But it would seem, of course, that a lot of government policy was not complied with, and therefore it's necessary that corrective measures be taken in regard to those.
The appointment of Tshilofelo Molefe as financial director instead of Siule, as recommended by the board, can you talk to that particular aspect, because that was part of your presentation? Why Tshilofelo Molefe and not Siule? Because from what you were saying earlier, seemingly there was an indication that Siule might not be more appropriate to work in a political environment. But was it from Siule or was it from the agents that were responsible for procurement?
Thank you. It was from himself in response to a question which was asked by the agent. So there were a number of factors which informed the decision we took. The first one was obviously that. The other one, and they're not in any order of preference, the other one related to the remuneration. He was receiving 4.2 billion rand bonus in addition to 4.2 million, in addition to the 4.2 million rand in his annual salaries. And if you take that, it amounts to 8.4 million rand. And the previous financial director had earned a total remuneration of 5.9 million rand when you considered the long and short term incentives. So if you looked at that, obviously you would be earning as a financial director far above the CEO of Eskom and far above the median that had been set for remuneration at state-owned companies, particularly of the size of Eskom and Transnet. But thirdly, we're looking at transformation, because none of the qualifications of Tshilofelo Molefe disqualified her to take the post. She was a CA. She had worked at Eskom. She understood the company inside out. She had worked at Eskom for quite a long time, and so she qualified to be considered ahead of Mr. Siule.
So in essence, that was from the recruitment agency, not from Siule himself.
No, it was from him.
Okay.
In response to the question the recruitment agency asked, because in itself, the recruitment agency would not have arrived at the conclusion that he says he can't work in a political environment unless he himself said so.
The appointment of Saluj and the extension of his term, which you said was questioned at the time, what were the issues that people were questioning around that appointment?
No, the appointment of Saluj was not questioned. I think it's been questioned subsequently, I think, in recent years, as to why he was appointed and why was his contract extended. And I sought to clarify that you had here somebody who had extensive experience in, he held a master's degree equivalent qualification from the National Defense Force. He had extensive experience in the defense industry, and he possessed all the wherewithal you needed for the CEO of DINEL. And he was a leading candidate from the recruitment process undertaken by the board. Now, when the request in 2013 came to me for the extension of his contract, I did not just willy-nilly approve it. I said to the board, there are the following guidelines. Comply with those guidelines, because if Mr. Saluchi was appointed by cabinet, if we must extend his contract, I am now changing the conditions upon which cabinet had appointed him. I would need to go back to cabinet and inform cabinet of the need to extend his contract and the reasons why. So I said to them, meet these guidelines, which would involve an extensive annual report on his performance. Once you yourselves have satisfied yourselves as to the compliance with those guidelines, you can then bring the recommendation back to me, at which point I will consider, which is what they then did, I think, in February 2014, and then I took it to cabinet so that his contract would be extended by another 2 years. But obviously it doesn't apply to him personally. It just means that any new CEO of Dinel would now have a 5-year contract going forward.
You appointed Mr. Singh as CFO, am I right?
The board did, and I concurred with them.
And at the time, you were convinced he was the best candidate?
At the time, I was, and the board was convinced. He had been with Transnet since 2003. He had been acting financial director, CFO, since 2009, and he had performed well, they said, and so he was the most suitable candidate.
It's fine. But my question is, after what happened that led to the where we are now, Do you still hold the view that you are the best candidate?
It's a difficult question, Honorable Member. It's a difficult question because I don't have the powers to read the future. In hindsight, you would say, yes, it was not the best decision. But the decisions we take today, we obviously account for them in the future. We don't know what is going to happen in the future. Much may happen. We ourselves will change. And should we then be said that the decisions we took when different facts were before us are therefore changed the fact that when different facts were before us, we took the decisions we took? If these facts available in 2017 were available in 2011 when this decision was taken 6 years earlier, I'm sure we would have taken a different decision. But as you correctly note, it was 6 years before new facts arose and we didn't know what was going to be the case later.
If you were to appoint a CEO for Eskom today, for example, will you appoint Mr. C as a CFO?
I think in that regard, I'm on record last year, both in calling for his suspension on the board of, as a CFO and on the board of Eskom, and later, early this year, asking him and the other members of the executive of a committee of Eskom to do the right thing and step down on their own, which he did, and I appreciate that. But I think when new facts were presented before us, I did not prevaricate.
The trillion arrangement saga and together happened after you have left the department. And as you roughly indicated, you ordered a forensic investigation. What were the findings? And if the findings are not there, did you at some stage check progress with regard to that particular aspect?
I'm sure that the National Treasury should be able to provide that report once the forensic investigation is completed. But we took the decision that the Tegeta deal should be subjected to a forensic audit, and that is taking place.
From having that point of view, what were the issues? Why forensic investigation?
Quite clearly, a wrong decision had been taken with regard to the Tegeta contract. And so once the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer came back with a report that said this thing has been irregular, this contract should not have been entered into by Eskom, I felt that in order for us to know what to do next, it's not enough to just say the contract is irregular. We need to go further to now delve deeply into who did what, therefore who should be held accountable, and what would be the recommendations of the forensic investigation in terms of this contract, so that we can take the correct decision and save government money.
Let's go to the New Age sponsored breakfast, Minister. You are worried about large sums of money being spent on breakfast in the midst of large build projects, which I agree. And over and above that, there was a whistleblower report that says procurement processes were flouted. There was also the CISO and Salu Wagobodo report and other things. But the minister's instruction only says in future these matters must be handled through the department. It does not say anything about the need for us to stop this kind of a program which was irregularly entered into.
The intention, the public protector was investigating these issues. And so we were satisfied, and that's why I issued an instruction that all information required in this regard, be it from the department or the relevant state-owned companies, must be sent directly to the Public Protector's Office rather than via the Minister of Public Enterprises. We thought that that would suffice to deal with the investigation. So what we interested ourselves in was the management of these, because at the time the public broadcaster was also involved, and it being involved with the intention of publicizing government programs and providing ministers with a 2-hour platform to account to the country on the aspects of their work and to respond to various stakeholders and the questions that they are asking. We thought we should deal with how do we manage such programs going forward. And that's why we then issued the directives that don't just enter into these, much as they fall within the underneath the significance and materiality framework, but just consult with us, because issues of this nature are of public concern, and we would need to provide guidance before you can take a decision that you are spending money on these programs or not.
Is the minister aware of what came to be known as the whistleblower report, which was talking about a whole range of affairs, issues which were happening in the company, Eskom? Is the minister aware of that document?
No, I'm not aware of that document.
Okay.
Thanks, Honorable Tsedi. Honorable Mazon.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Minister Gigaba. I'm very glad that you're feeling better this week, and I hope your health continues to improve. Minister Gigaba, I'd like to start the questioning today with asking you about your relationship with the Gupta family. We have been shown your invitation to a Diwali function And you yourself have said that you attended the Diwali function at their home. We also know that you attended the wedding that they had at Sun City. And I'd like to know, at what point were you actually introduced to the Gupta family, and why were you introduced to them?
I was actually not formally introduced. I think it was in the course of these invitations to Diwali and subsequently to the wedding that I met them and got introduced to them. So it was not a formal introduction, and there is nobody I can attribute to that responsibility of having introduced me. A number of other ministers were being invited to these activities. They attended. A number of other political figures were being invited, and they attended. And eventually, we started trickling out because of various reasons.
Now, Minister, why do you think you were invited in the first place? I mean, to me, especially a religious function, such as a Diwali celebration, it's a personal thing. And I would find it very strange, just a random family inviting very high-profile politicians to something as intimate as a Diwali celebration. And while I understand that the Sun City wedding was a large event, again, it's a very personal thing. I mean, you yourself had a wedding that was rather large, and you know, you invited your friends and colleagues, certainly not sheer strangers. So why do you think that these invitations went out to you in the first place?
I don't know why they went out to me, but people do these things. I get invited to graduation ceremonies of people I have not met, but they feel that, you know, you being there adds value, adds character to the ceremony. But the fact of the matter is that people have different reasons why they do these things. And I have found that particularly many people in business would go even to an extent of inviting celebrities and even paying the celebrities to appear at their functions. It seems to be a common thing. And that's why I did not find it particularly peculiar, and the only guarantee was that it's a religious function. Actually, when I was still living in Durban, I got invited to a number of religious activities of different religious and cultural families and individuals. I didn't find it to be an intrusion into their privacy, because there is nothing of significance that was discussed there, except exchanging pleasantries, asking about how is the political situation, blah, 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 but it's nothing of significance that gets discussed. No decisions get taken there.
Now, Mr. Gigaba, Minister Gigaba, rather, you might find this a bit strange, but let me preempt why I ask this. You obviously received an invitation to the Gupta wedding. Now, this invitation has been described as a treasure chest, and inside were incredibly beautifully crafted Indian bottles that contained truffles from Switzerland, cranberries from the Northern Americas, dried kiwi fruits from the Australias, dried mangoes from Africa, golden berries from South America, persimmons from Asia, and other luxury items. You were a minister at the time that this amazing gift arrived. Did you declare that you had received this gift?
I cannot recollect. I will have to check.
Chair, can we just place on record that Minister Gigaba is going to come back to us with that answer? Minister Gigaba, your relationship with President Jacob Zuma, clearly a favoured member of his cabinet. You went from being the Minister of State-Owned Enterprises to being Minister of Home Affairs, and then to the very illustrious position of being Minister of Finance, now in the cabinet reshuffle being one of the ministers that's retained and back in your position at Home Affairs. At any time during your relationship with previous President Jacob Zuma, were you ever instructed to appoint certain members to boards in any way via messages at his house, through direct interaction? In other words, did President Zuma or anyone affiliated with President Zuma ever instruct you as to how to appoint certain members of a board?
No, I was not. I would go to the president to consult prior to taking any memo to cabinet, and the president would not say to me, take this one out, bring this one on, because I think you should put that person on the board. I don't necessarily think that I am a favored member, or I was a favored member of President Zuma's cabinet. I think the ministers played different roles. You are assessed on the basis of your different skills, and you are assigned responsibilities based on those skills. That doesn't necessarily make you a favored member of the cabinet. There are many people who, during his presidency, were never reshuffled, and that doesn't make them any favorites. And in addition to that, you will also remember that I was not the first or even the second option for the position of finance minister. That is on public record. So it's not as if from the outset in 2015, when the first reshuffle took place in the finance portfolio, I was the first person to be sent there. And you also know it on record, at least from public record, that I was also not the second option. There is someone else who was being earmarked for that position of finance minister. And when that could not happen because of disagreements within the tripartite alliance and among the officials of the ruling party, that's when my name came in. So I can't say that I was the favored member. But in addition to that, I mean, if I was appointed to do certain things at public enterprises and I did them so well, why move me? Why don't you let me continue doing those things? Within a year after I was appointed at Home Affairs, the boards I had appointed, if they had been appointed to do certain things, they were changed virtually altogether. Why change them if they had been established to do certain things? So I think here, you know, facts and conjecture do not necessarily go hand in hand.
Minister Kigaba, what you've just said interests me. So before I carry on with my questioning, I'm going to focus on what you've just said. Within a year of you leaving, boards that you'd established had changed. Now, it's undeniable that boards certainly did change, but they just simply changed companies. The boards remained the same. They just moved from one entity to the next. Would you not agree that it is a bit strange that people went from working at Transnet to working at Eskom to sometimes working at Denel? It seemed like a revolving door policy that took place. Certainly no new blood was entered into until very recently. And that brings me to something you said just now. You said that the old Eskom board was removed because you felt that they were too closely linked to aspects that had been happening, and it was a recommendation that they were removed because of that. Minister Kigaba, I put it to you that that's not at all the case. I put it to you that they were removed because they had to be removed. And in fact, on the appointment of acting CEO Phakamani Khadebe and appointed chairperson Jabu Mabuza, they literally walked in and cleared out, not because it was suggested that people were too closely linked, but because it was proven fact that there were people that needed to be placed on suspension. And we as a committee visited Eskom, and we were told in no uncertain circumstances that there was no other choice but to move in, clear out, and to reappoint a completely new and competent board.
Honourable Member, you are obviously confusing boards which are composed of non-executive directors overwhelmingly with executive directors. To move Brian, for example, from Transnet to Eskom is not tantamount to moving the board of Transnet to Eskom. To move Anoch from Transnet to Eskom is not tantamount to moving the Transnet board from Transnet to Eskom. The boards themselves were changed. That's when you had Dr. Ben Ngubane coming in as the chairperson of Eskom. You have Mr. Zethembe Khoza and other board members of Eskom that came in. The board of Mafika Mkhwanazi was changed and new board members were appointed. So that's a fact. Having established that fact and having agreeing that to move an executive director from one company to the next is within acceptable limits. I mean, at the time when Brian was moved to Eskom, everybody hailed the transfer as a good decision. And in the course of that, everybody thought he would do well, as he did, to stabilize the electricity situation. And we all appreciated that. But that doesn't mean that you took the board of Transnet and moved it to Eskom. Secondly, the question regarding the changes that took place recently at Eskom, yes, they took place because they had to be changed. It was necessary to implement those changes because there were a number of difficulties that the company was experiencing. Just to cite some of the reasons, the company was in need of about 20 billion rand, which would be required by February this year for it to be able to continue operating and continue with the build program. The lenders, the banks, were refusing to finance that financial requirement. Eskom had gone on a bond roadshow and nobody was willing to take it. And as we said, the National Treasury would not have 20 billion rand to give to Eskom. Secondly, Eskom was not meeting its requirements in terms of its World Bank loan. The conditions which were set, including the environmental commitments, including the IPPs, the signing off of power purchase agreements, including a number of other commitments that needed to be signed off, were not being signed off. There was a problem, in part created by a policy stalemate which involved the Department of Energy, but also in part created by an unwillingness on the part of the DPE and Eskom itself to go ahead with the signing of the PPAs and the compliance with the conditions the World Bank had set. What it would have done is to cause a run-in on the loans of Eskom if the World Bank, as a $3.7 billion lender to Eskom, had called their loan in. It would have created a cross default. It would have created massive problems for the economy. So you needed to take a decision, and to take a drastic decision. I mean, this is in addition to all the other issues that have been asked about during this inquiry, that have been spoken about. It required that we take a drastic decision, and that drastic decision had to be taken. As I say, it was necessary that somebody senior, trusted by the market, coming out of Eskom, had to be appointed to act as CEO to allow the company to transit through these difficulties. And that's when the name of Phakamani Hadebe came in, with his experience at the Land Bank, his stellar performance at APSA. You needed someone of that stature, and other board members that have since been appointed. So these were all the reasons that required that there be both changes at Eskom.
Minister, you see, I tend to agree with you to a large extent what you said as to why there needed to be changes. I mean, the changes were obvious. But that would mean that given what you've just said to us, and I assume that you've told us that about the World Bank from your experience as being Minister of Finance, as well as your background experience in public enterprises, that I'm left with no conclusion but to make other than the board of Eskom was delinquent because of what they had done to come to this state of the World Bank crisis, the loan crisis that you've just explained, as well as DPE. I mean, you yourself had said that there were difficulties with DPE. So that makes me, sort of believe that we had a delinquent minister as well as a delinquent board. So I thank you for that bit of background and that honesty. Minister, while you were the Minister of State-Owned Enterprises, Zola Tsotsi was your Eskom board chair, and you served together quite well for some time. Mr. Tsotsi came here and gave some very damning evidence, and evidence that I think shook not only this committee but the country to its core. In his evidence, he told us how he was summoned to the ex-president's homestead and informed by Ms. Dudu Mayeni as to how board appointments at Eskom should be made. Now, given that you were the stakeholder in government and the person to whom he answered, was this ever reported to you? And if so, what was your reaction?
No, this was never reported to me by Mr. Tsotsi. And obviously, the direction of Ms. Mieni, of her advice to Mr. Tsotsi as to how board appointments should take place was misdirected, because it's the minister via the department that makes board recommendations to cabinet. You will remember at some point that while I was Minister of Public Enterprises, in 2014 specifically, I had made public strong remarks about the former chairperson of SAA. And expressed my very strong displeasure at her performance. And subsequently, when I became Minister of Finance, I then took the steps to ensure that we appoint a new chairperson at SAA. So I have not been influenced by Ms. Dudu Mieni, and I certainly would not be influenced by her or anybody. There's a number of people who, whenever you walk around, come up with suggestions. At times, people would come and say to you, the president said I must come and talk to you about this, or the SG has said I must come and talk to you about this. And my response is always simple. Since I'm appointed by the president, if the president wants to give me an instruction, he will call me and tell me. I won't listen to you. Or, whilst I'm here standing with you, will you call him and tell him that he must confirm what you are claiming to me? And people retreat as soon as you do that. But it's something that I never accept when somebody comes to me and says that and tries to name drop my principles. I never accept that.
I'm very glad to hear that, Minister Gigaba, and I do find it quite worrying that someone would try and compromise you in that kind of way. I wonder if you'd share with this committee an example of someone who'd come to you and name drop the name of the president, as you've just indicated, and you very sternly said, no, I will not listen to you, in fact, phone the president now.
It's as I say, I mean, I don't have anybody off head. I mean, I would need to remember that, because you are talking about something which happened over 4 years ago when I was at Public Enterprises. But As I say, people, whenever they try to do that with me, that is my standard response, and they retreat. They never come back to me.
And
for the record, I never get a comeback from the principal saying to me, I had asked somebody to come and talk to you, and you didn't listen to them.
Chairperson, we must just note that Minister Gigaba is going to come back to us once he recalls one of the names of the people mentioned. Mr. Gigaba, Salim Issa has played a huge role in terms of this inquiry. His name has come up repeatedly. In state capture, which is now known not to be a concept but to be a very real thing, the name has continuously come up. And we cannot ignore the fact that Salim Issa's involvement in state-owned entities dates back to October 2011, when in fact he was appointed as the head of the tender committee for Broadband Infraco. And what I find strange, and I can't get my head around, is this construct of a board tender committee was established in state-owned entities during your tenure as minister. And it started out at Broadband Infraco that we had these board tender committees, TBCs as they now know, becoming an entity within state-owned entities. And then we see them popping up everywhere else. Now, Salim Issa has been linked over and over and over again to so many different areas of our state-owned entities that he's almost endemically involved. There's not an entity that he hasn't had a finger in the pie of. Who introduced you to Salim Issa, and how did it come about? Because this happened during when you were there. How did it come about that this man arrived, was appointed, and amassed such a large of power that he could go from Broadband Infraco into so many different spheres?
All I can confirm is appointing him on the board of Broadband Infraco, but not as chairman of the board tender committee. That was the internal functioning of the board. But it would seem that with hindsight, one would not back then have had perspective of the people who came in and were appointed to head tender committees or something like that, because it would not, at the face of it, seem to be anything peculiar. There are many board committees that are established. There are many people who serve on those board committees. When he was appointed into the board of Broadband Infraco, he was a very experienced and seasoned ICT executive and businessman, and he seems to be bringing a skill we required at the time when we had taken the view that Broadband Infraco needs to be merged with either Centec or with Telkom so that it's able to play its role in the provision of broadband infrastructure in the country.
Minister, I hear what you're saying when you say that Salim Issa bought a skill that you required. But I'd argue that now that we've gone through such a long deliberation and investigation into the various boards, and although we concentrate specifically here on Eskom, we have delved into Denel and Transnet, it would appear that people were being appointed who weren't perhaps the best skilled people for the job at hand. And I think that shows, because people were appointed and then things started to collapse around them. And I think it goes to a deep misunderstanding of what people's roles were in state-owned entities and the reason that people were appointed to the board. Now, you earlier said that I didn't understand the difference between a non-executive and an executive. And I can tell you that if anyone does, it certainly would be me. But that's why, I have to ask this. People like Rajesh Nathani, who was an Indian national with absolutely no airline industry, was appointed to the SAA board and then shifted by yourself to SA Express. Now, this appointment has come up numerous times in Gupta mails. And it's the Gupta leaked mails. And, Minister, I must tell you, I personally, in the House, handed up the Gupta leaked emails, and I had marked envelopes for each one of the ministers, and it was handed to the Speaker of the House, and one of those envelopes was marked for you. So if you haven't received the Gupta leaked emails, I strongly suggest that you question the National Assembly table as to why that envelope wasn't given to you, as it was given to all the other ministers who I addressed it to. And this particular individual was shown in those emails, and I gave those emails to you, to have asked Tony Gupta to even inquire with you to positions that were available at Transnet. Now, these don't sound like people that should have been appointed to the board in the first place. And in your earlier testimony, you said that you were advised to appoint management positions. Just give us a background understanding of who gave you this advice and whose advice you would count on in appointing or agreeing with the appointments made by boards.
The appointments to boards, as I indicated in my presentation, are sourced by the department from various sources. They would include board recommendations, they would include the database that is established by the department. And obviously, in the course of that, two things could happen. One, a person could be appointed to bring in, as we were trying to do at SAA, an international expert who would assist SAA in the establishment of its international networks, spearhead that role, assist the board in dealing with that. And when it became clear to me that, but this gentleman did not have the skill that we thought he would assist us with, we then moved him. But obviously the issue of him serving positions at Transnet, of him and his interest at positions at Transnet, I was not aware of that. He never raised it either with me. In actual fact, I hardly ever interacted with this gentleman except on one or two occasions when he did attend the board when I was in attendance, and I did not have a direct discussion with him, as my interest would be on the broad topics that I would have come to address with the board, and as soon as we conclude those, it was not in my interest to discuss people's personal interests and the boards in which they intended to serve or positions which they thought they would want to have. It really was not in my interest to do that.
So I want to take you back, Minister Gigaba, to the breakfast, which my colleague touched on briefly and the Advocate Venara also touched on briefly. I want to speak specifically about the amounts of money that we're dealing with here, because I think that we've become so desensitized in South Africa to the word million that we automatically now refer to billion. You did it yourself earlier. You said billion and then said million. And that's absolutely understandable, because the amounts of money we deal with are so obscene, and certainly the amounts of money in state capture are so obscene that we're used to using the word billion. But I think it's fair to say that your average South African will never dream of seeing a million rand in his or her lifetime. It's an unfortunate fact that we have to be very aware of. Now, between November 2011 and the financial year end of 2012, a truly bizarre amount of money was spent on New Age breakfasts. And I'll break it down for you, because I know that you can't be expected to remember this out of your head. It was 17.5 million rand for 18 breakfasts with New Age from Eskom. And 7.2 million rand for 6 breakfasts between 2011 and 2012 by Transnet. Now, as a minister, you must now know that New Age is owned by the Gupta family. Things are starting to surface, the wedding, the airport landings. There's controversy, without a doubt. It's public. You don't need a Gupta mail for it. It's public. You and I are great Twitteratis. I see you comment on these things on Twitter. So you knew that this particular family was now being linked to certain, what the young people describe as dodgy dealings. When did you take action? And what excuse was given to you for these obscenely large amounts of money being spent from state-owned entities that belong to me, to my colleagues sitting next to me, to the left, to the right, to every South African? How was this explained away?
As I say in my presentation, in early 2011, numerous state-owned companies informed the department that they were receiving requests from other government departments and state-owned companies in relation to sponsorships and so on. Now, around that time, I also became aware that the New Age wanted sponsorships from Transnet and Eskom for Business Breakfast. As I say, I was upset at the huge amount of money, and I took the decision to write to the boards of all the state-owned companies that even though this was below the materiality threshold and was strictly within the operational purview of the board, it was going to be necessary that in matters of this nature, the department should be consulted so that we are able to take a view and inform the various state-owned companies in relation to these issues. Now, the question was asked earlier, why did I not say to them, stop right away? As I say, the matter was below the materiality threshold. I placed it to the board to take the decisions, bearing in mind that that whatever decisions they take must bear in mind public concern about the issue. But obviously the public broadcaster was also involved, and I think that in part created a dilemma for some of the state-owned companies in relation to these issues, because at the face of it, this was a good program which allowed government to communicate its programs to the public. But obviously, with hindsight, we now know that the processes that were being implemented, the programs that were being implemented, were inappropriate and should have been stopped right away. But you know, you face that dilemma as a minister between interfering in operational matters, interfering in issues that are within the materiality threshold of state-owned companies, and being able to bring to the boards and the companies themselves the level, the conscience to take the correct decisions on certain issues.
Minister Gigaba, a company called Tequesta Group is a Gupta-linked company. And, I mean, it's well known, it's in the public domain. Tequesta would eventually go on to earn 21% of every deal gained by the China South Rail Corporation. And that's been a 5.3 billion rand deal since 2014. And understand, again, Minister Gigaba, here comes the Gupta link. And you must understand that for us it's incredibly worrying as we, as the new Minister of Public Enterprises always said, we join the dots and we fill out the web of state capture as we go through our investigations. Now, you speak a lot about hindsight, and if we had known, or, you know, if we hadn't. Certainly as a minister, at some point, you have to stop and say, how is it possible that the same family is involved in so many deals within our state-owned entities? And you raise a red flag. Because, Minister Gigaba, I've been with you for a very long time. We go back to when you were first appointed as Shadow Minister. And, Chair, just for the record, we go back even further than that, Minister Gigaba was a youth leader at the same time as I was. Now, I would expect, you know, when the same family that's now been shown to be controversial, constantly in the news, such a lot of skeletons coming out of the closet, and not small Anyana skeletons, we're talking about big skeletons, that I would raise a red flag. Minister Gigaba, you never raised a red flag. Why not? Why were you comfortable with this if nobody else in the country was?
But remember that I was not involved in deciding who gets what contract where. I was not. I was a minister. My role with regard to the 1064 procurement ended when I signed the Section 54 approval, which, as I said, is a statement of policy. Go ahead with the procurement, meet the following conditions, and thereafter, the onus is on you. You expect that the board would exercise oversight to ensure there is no corruption. You expect that the executives would do the same. None of that. You see, they don't come back to the minister to say, Minister, we have Tequesta Company. Here are the shareholders, this does this, this does that. You don't sit and receive documentation and information in that regard, because what it would do, it would raise questions as to your level of interest in such detail. You could say that ministers need to do that, but there is a risk in doing that. Ministers must remain out of procurement in state-owned companies as well as in their departments. So the issue of who was involved, including the China South Rail, all of those issues were matters which became known once the contracts were signed and once the issues were being raised, and at which point I had left public enterprises and I read about them as everybody else. Am I alarmed by it? Of course I am. There's absolutely no way I would sit and say, geez, these things have happened, these wrong things have happened, and because I am no longer in the portfolio, then it's okay, I move away and pay no attention. Yes, I am concerned. Yes, I worry that such things have taken place. But at the time that they happened, I, as a minister, was not involved in deciding who gets what tender. In the portfolio at which I am now, I am not involved and will not involve myself in who gets what tender in the Department of Home Affairs. I leave that to the Director General and the officials that are assigned to know that information and to take those decisions. So that if and when they make mistakes of this nature, I can be the final arbiter on the matter and take the decisions that protect public interest.
Now, you see, Mr. Gigaba, I find that statement to be a passing the buck statement. And I'm sure many people are going to agree with me. You are, after all, the minister. The buck stops with you. Let me finish. You are the stakeholder. You are the representative of government. Now, to say that a minister must stay out, Mr. Gigaba, I put it to you that you are not the kind of minister that stays out of these kind of things. And we've seen it in your tenure as Minister of Home Affairs. You don't stay out of affairs. You get intrinsically involved with issues.
I get intrinsically involved in policy decisions. I don't get involved in tenders. I don't involve myself in it. And it's wrong to say ministers must involve themselves in tenders. I want to put it on record. Ministers must not. Against your better advice, I offer advice to ministers. They must not get involved in tenders. They must stay away.
Minister Gigaba.
Sorry, Honorable Mazon. Minister, can we please give each other time? It's sometimes, I know it's sometimes you don't want to miss the point that you want to say, it gets difficult when you let it go and you forget. But don't interrupt each other.
Chair, no need for apologies. This is an emotional issue, and I can see that Minister Gigaba is emotional about it, and that's okay. I would be emotional about it too. I don't say that ministers should get involved in tenders, so I don't think you should misconstrue what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I expect a minister to take ownership for what's going on in his or her department. And as I said to Minister Lynn Brown when she appeared before us, I'm going to say it to you. I think that you were derelict in your duty as minister to allow these contracts to be going ahead, knowing that Guptas were involved in every aspect of your department, of which you were the minister stakeholder, and you did not raise a red flag. Now, I'm afraid that you are going to have to do a lot more convincing, because I am not buying the story at all that you did not know what was going on in your entities. If I, as a shadow minister and member of a portfolio committee, know exactly who is getting a tender from annual reports and reports that are given through to a portfolio committee, then Minister Gigaba, you had to have known, and you had to have had even more intimate knowledge of these contracts than I did. And Minister Gigaba, you'll note that I'm keeping a very calm, and I'm taking a very calm tone with you about this, because I understand that you've got a lot to deal with in these answers. But the fact of the matter is, if you take a high leadership position, great responsibility comes with that high leadership position. And I don't think, as Minister of Public Enterprises, you took enough ownership of what was the beginning of state capture. And Chair, I just want to read a segment of a judgment. And it's a judgment that was released about a week and a half ago. And in the judgment it says, Minister Gigaba was found to have, inverted commas, deliberately told untruths under oath, closed commas. Furthermore, his decisions and conduct in the matter were found to be so far out of step with the law that Judge Tuchin concluded that, open inverted commas, the minister has committed a serious breach of the Constitution, so serious that I could characterize it as a violation. Chairperson, I'm going to close with a statement that I would say that given the extent of state capture that we've uncovered in this inquiry, I would go so far as to say the minister not only erred in this particular court case, but I think that the minister erred greatly in his role as a shadow minister of public enterprises, and I think that as minister of state-owned entities, you should have realized that there was state capture taking place under your nose, you should have raised the flag, and you should have taken much stronger action than you did to stop it. No further questions, Chair.
Thank you very much. The Honourable Member makes many infectual observations. First, contradicts herself, having argued that I should have involved myself in the tenders, and changes and says, you were not saying I should have. That's the first point. You argued that I was passing the buck in not involving myself in tenders in the state-owned companies. I wish to insist that I did not pass the buck. It's the responsibility of ministers not to involve themselves in tenders, either in their departments or in state-owned companies under their portfolios. Secondly, the Honourable Member says, I was dereliting my duty to allow these contracts to go ahead because they are reported in annual reports. But when the annual report of Transnet was presented, I was no longer Minister of Public Enterprises. You say yourself that these issues of who gets what contracts get reported in annual reports. I want to insist, it would be wrong for ministers to, as the contracts are going on, to take a keen interest in who is getting contracts. That in itself would raise alarm. And ministers should maintain the view. So sure, you can get to know at the end of the year when the annual report is prepared. If I was still Minister of Public Enterprises, perhaps I would say, yeah, you are correct. But I was not Minister of Public Enterprises, and I was focused on my new responsibility. The Honourable Member makes an insinuation that I get involved is evidenced in Home Affairs. I have not involved myself in the contracts at Home Affairs. In no contract have I involved myself at Home Affairs. I think what the Honourable Member is trying to do is to conjure up justification for her theory, but that doesn't explain the theory. The theory is flawed. And all the other arguments that the Honourable Member is trying to conjure up don't meet the false theory that the Honourable Member has created. They don't come together. Then the Honourable Member goes further to say, and I see this is a moving target now, that a week and a half ago, the judgment said I was derelict, I was on the issue of fire blade, I had lied. 2 weeks ago, more than a week and a half ago, an Honourable Member from his part, from her party said a week ago. Which week exactly are the Honourable Members talking about? But let me help the Honourable Member. This is a judgment in December, which is a judgment subsequent to a judgment in October, where on the matter of the fire blade versus the Department of Home Affairs, the ruling was in favor of fire blade, that the fire blade must be operated by the department, by fire blade, and that the Department of Home Affairs must come and provide immigration officers. The judgment of December and of October are sub judice because they are being appealed. Of course, we are engaging with these issues. And I hope the Honourable Member understands the context in which the judgment was made, because it was not based on the facts of how ports of entry are established and determined. It was based on a minute that was formulated by one party and not concurred with by the other party. Secondly, it's based on a submission which was leaked but which did not contain the opinions of other stakeholders on the issue at hand. And so that we were going to appeal those issues is without any doubt. It has to be. And once there is an appeal on any ruling to a senior court, it means that the ruling is suspended. But I'm sure that the Honourable Member didn't know this fact. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Minister. Honourable Swart.
Thank you, Chairperson. Minister Gigaba, in your submission you make a number of assertions and you state, for example, on page 1, it has been disheartening and shocking for me to witness some of the appointments that I made years ago and which were held publicly as positive appointments for government now being impugned. Would you, and then at the right at the end of your document, you also indicate, I'm severely disappointed that these roles appear to have in certain instances been abused. That's roles of SOCs. And I regret any role I inadvertently played in the appointment of any director who subsequently failed to prioritize the interests of the relevant SOC and, more importantly, this country. So to me, would you agree that there, with hindsight, one always has hindsight, that there were clearly mistakes made, not necessarily with the appointment, but had one taken greater care and one sees subsequent developments that would have caused you to reach that conclusion. Is that correct?
Yes, what it means, Honorable Swart, is that, you know, when you take a decision, you take it without any malice. You think you are acting in the best interests of country and company. And once things happen, develop in later years, you then regret the fact that what you thought at the time you took a decision was a genuine intention has turned out the way it did, because there was no desire or intention on my part to appoint anybody who would at a later stage be mired in the types of controversies as we are dealing with.
And is it correct, and we've had a bit of a briefing on this, that you rely quite heavily on your departmental officials when it comes to the appointment of boards, and I think you indicated that there could be an improvement in that regard. You spoke about vetting, I think, as well. Is that correct?
Indeed, yes, it's true.
So clearly now, when one looks back at some of the appointments, and if one starts with the appointment of Mr. Colin Matshila, again, hindsight is perfect sight, and we see with his appointment in June 2011, and did I understand you correctly that you don't play any role in the appointment of acting executives? Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And here, when we appointed him, we were appointing an ex-CEO the National Energy Regulator. So he fitted the bill of the Eskom board. He came from the sector, he understood it.
And now, he was appointed by you on June 2011, and as acting CEO on the 1st of April 2014, you wouldn't have played any role in that, the acting CEO position.
Yes. When the request was made to me, I deferred it to the board and said, it's your decision, you decide who is going to act as CEO. I will only get involved once we've completed the recruitment process for the permanent CE.
Because as we now know, in terms of the leaked Gupta emails, that on the 22nd of March, Mr. Salim Issa sent Mr. Machila's CV to Mr. Tony Gupta, and Mr. Tony Gupta forwarded the CV to Mr. Duduzana Zuma on the 23rd of March, and he was then appointed 1 week later as CEO. Now, clearly, one can contest the veracity of those leaked emails, but you would say that you had no role to play in that appointment.
I had absolutely no role, and nobody spoke to me about that. I was only informed post facto, and I was seized with the preparations for the new CE. But obviously we were also in an election period around that time, elections being in April. I was head of the ANC's election campaign. I was busy involved in that election campaign, and so it was the board that took that decision. Whether they themselves knew or some among them were influenced towards that effect is something that I would like to know. But I never got the chance to have to ask, because after the elections I moved immediately to another department.
Yes, and we also now know that Mr. Matshila shared a directorship with Mr. Salim Issa in Inca Energy, and through his company Matlapeng Resources, Mr. Matshila is a 59% shareholder in New Shelf Pty Limited, where he's a co-director with the CEO of Oak Bay Resources. So you see the link already, but again, it's hindsight. At that stage, one might not have understood the implications going forward of these links. But obviously, the issue is, how does one screen the appointment of a director with links with other companies? And we saw that with Mr. Mark Pomensky, who was appointed subsequent to you, who also sat as a director of Oak Bay Resources. clearly it's a challenge that one needs to look at. Which companies do you identify? Now we can look back and say those companies were all linked with the Guptas, were linked with a state-owned enterprise and a plan. But clearly one needs to find a way. How do we, going forward, look at screening the appointment of directors? What would your comment be on that?
That would be absolutely correct, Honourable Member, that we need to find a better and more sophisticated way of screening. You see, in this instance, you have, let me leave, Kepinski?
Mark Pemenski.
Yes.
Yeah.
Let me leave that one because I don't know much about. But the two were not in the same boat. You know, one was at Eskom, the other one was at Broadband Infraco. There was nothing that immediately connected them within the SOC environment, perhaps with the exception of Mr. Mkwanazi, whom we appointed into the boards of both Eskom and Transnet in view of the road to rail migration and the delays that were being experienced in relation to that and the attempts on our part to bridge the gaps. At some point, I facilitated a meeting between Mr. Brian Dames and Brian Modife to facilitate a speeding up of that road to rail migration program. Besides Mr. Mkwanazi, that we put on the board of Eskom also to address this. The other people, we were meticulous to ensure that we don't recycle people within SOEs, especially within our portfolio, and we don't allow anybody to serve on many boards within the portfolio. A tradition which I also introduced at Treasury, so that people focus on the boards in which they have been appointed. But obviously when there are underground networks and cables that are taking place, we then must depend on state security agencies to be able to bring this to light to us so that we are able to connect the dots and take the right decisions.
The issue of, you raised the issue of your concerns about the New Age breakfasts, and you sent a letter. Now, I don't think you dated that, but in fairness to you, but on the 30th of April 2014, that was within a month of being appointed as acting CEO, Mr. Machilo, he approved that 43 million rand contract with Eskom to sponsor the Gupta's New Age business breakfast. Would you remember, would that have, was your caution before or after that? And it might be unfair to ask you because dates, it's going back a long time ago.
My caution was before that. And I think what could have been happening, as I say, we were in the midst of an election process. I was heading an election campaign of my party. People may have taken advantage of the gap there to take certain decisions that would obviously lead to particular causes.
And that we see the chief financial officer at the time, Ms. Molefe, refused to sign that contract, which benefited a Gupta-related company, and she must have also been aware of your caution as well. But notwithstanding that, that contract went ahead, and we now know that there was actions taken following that, the actions being that Ms. Molefe, Mr. Matona, this is subsequent to you, I suppose, were Mr. Matona, who was then the CEO, Mr. Matona, Don Maracona, and Mr. Michelle Coco were suspended. That was the following year. So you can clearly see with hindsight, here you have Ms. Molefe that wasn't prepared to be compliant with a pro-Gupta contract. You had a pushback, and we have evidence before us of certain executives that said if you were seen to be on the one side of the board, that's Ms. Molefe, she said very keenly, if you were anti-Gupta-related companies, you would have been sidelined. So as minister, Would you have been aware of this at all at the time?
Ms. Molefe never brought to my attention that there was a push by any so-called Gupta-related allies for any particular decisions. Obviously, what would happen subsequent to the 2014 elections, I would not have been privy to it, but I think I applaud the stance she took because I had written a directive in this regard. And it was peculiar that the board chose as an acting CE, someone who was a board member, and none of the senior executives that were there. Dan, Mr. Dr. Lennon, and even Mr. Nzokolo.
And it's of great concern to us that a person of the caliber of Ms. Molefe was sidelined, and when she gave evidence, she was obviously very distraught that her career had been destroyed, as had Mr. Matona and others in this push to capture Eskom.
Including attempts to describe Ms. Molefe as having been underqualified to hold the post of CFO, which, as I strenuously explained before the committee, she was well qualified.
And, of course, we know the Denton's report cleared all of those executives. There was nothing found to be, but they were clearly in the way of a certain agenda by Gupta-related companies, and that's why they had to be removed. Would you, in hindsight, agree with that?
Well, I would. You know, I think this would apply to a number of things. As I argued also earlier, if I myself had been doing such a great job advancing their interests, I doubt that then there would have been a push for my removal, much as my appointment in the fifth administration really was a new appointment, because the fifth administration was a new administration. But otherwise I would have been left to carry on doing the great job I'm alleged to have been doing.
And so with that view, it could well be that Mr. Essa did send Mr. Machila's CV to Mr. Gupta on the 22nd of March, because it plays into that narrative that could well have, although you don't have personal knowledge, but it could well have happened. Would you agree with that?
Could well have happened, given the fact that I think the fact that are emerging before us indicate that there was a lot of communication and background dealings that was taking place.
Just to move on to Mr. Zolotsotsi's evidence, which was startling, and I'm sure you would have, maybe your staff members were able to brief you on the content of his evidence, in particular in February 2015, by which stage you would no longer have been the minister. But I'm sure that this evidence, which was rendered right here in this venue, where he said it was in February 2015, he was approached by Mr. Tony Gupta, who requested that we meet. And at that meeting, Mr. Tony Gupta told me, "Chairman, that's chairman of the Eskom board, you are not helping us with anything. We are the ones who put you in the position you are in. We are the ones who can take you out." My response was, "Do what you have to do. Let me carry on the job that the cabinet appointed me to do." So ended that meeting. Now, that is a startling statement, because it seems to indicate that Mr. Tony Gupta, he speaks in the plural, one will presume that's him and his brothers, had in fact played a very key role in appointing him as chairman of the board. And that would have been at the time when you were minister, is that correct?
It would have been at the time I was minister, but I want to put it on record that they played no such role. I think he was playing marbles with him. He was trying to manipulate him and to intimidate him to think that he owes them any allegiance and therefore he must do what they want to do. And I think his response was appropriate, that do what you think you need to do, but he had to stand firm, and I applaud him for doing that.
But you do understand that it can also create the impression that, in fact, the Guptas, via the president and possibly via you, and I appreciate that you put it on record that they have played no role in you, but it can create the perception that they did, in fact, play a significant role.
It could create the impression indeed, but they played no such role to influence me. When I looked at Mr. Tsotsi, when we appointed Mr. Tsotsi, we considered his impeccable career record, and that's what influenced us. And he himself stood firm, and he did not come to me. He didn't call me, because even though I was no longer Minister of Public Enterprises, perhaps he would have, with hindsight, picked up the phone to say, Minister Kigaba, is this true? Was I appointed by or through these people? When we appointed him, we were not influenced by them at all. As I say, I think they were manipulating him. They were just simply playing marbles with him.
And I appreciate in that February of 2015 you were no longer the minister, but we alluded to this earlier, that on the 26th of February 2015 he was received a call, and he was then summoned to go to the Durban presidential residence on the 7th of March 2015, where he received instructions from Ms. Dudu Mayeni as to the suspension of the four executives that I referred to earlier. Would that not seem indicate to you, given what I've just mentioned to you, that Mr. Tony Gupta's assertion that he, in fact, is in control of some influence, and the President then indicates these, via Ms. Dudu Mayeni, that these are the people that are going to be suspended, again, to pursue a Gupta-aligned plan that the President himself was influenced by the Guptas?
All I can confirm is that during my tenure, Ms. Molefe was appointed and not threatened in any possible way and not suspended. Mr. Tsotsi himself was not threatened or summoned by anybody, and that Mr. Dan Marukane was also firmly in his position as a highly renowned executive at Eskom. He was under no suspension, and even Mr. Koko then was not suspended. So under my tenure, none of that happened. I think what happened thereafter could be an indication of the gap that got opened as soon as I was no longer in the position to exercise my responsibility as minister. I think honourable members could very well remember that there have been some media reports, even to the extent that, and I say this fully conscious of what it could mean. But there were reports to the extent that my own redeployment to Home Affairs in 2014 was announced to some people by Ms. Mieni prior to it happening, and it actually did materialize. So
That's an important point that you're just making, because it does then indicate that possibly the President, via Ms. Dudu Mayeni and others, was influencing matters. Because we know on the 7th of March, this very meeting, we know then on the 9th of March, according to Ms. Daniel's evidence and Mr. Masonga's evidence, that they were called to a meet with Mr. Salim Essa, who we know is a Gupta lieutenant, where they were told these executives were going to be suspended. And that is exactly what happened. And so we can clearly see, subsequent to your being minister, an acceleration of state capture at Eskom. Because we know immediately, and with your knowledge as the Minister of Finance then, and the Tegeta contracts where you called for a forensic investigation, we know as soon as Mr. Malefe arrived at Eskom, he stopped the negotiations with Glencore, stopped the hardship agreements of Optimum, and that whole lot of pressure that was then built him and Mr. Anuj Singh, which is an issue which you are investigating, that, well, you were, the National Treasury was with the forensic audit. So would you agree that it seems to, state capture of Eskom in particular, seems to have accelerated from that point on?
Of course, it would seem to be, I think, given the evidence that is now before us. But I myself never received an instruction by the President in any direction.
I appreciate that. I just want to then ask, as we go in forward, just briefly the issue of the locomotives, and I appreciate that's not a deep issue that you prepared for. This is the Eskom inquiry, but I just wanted to touch on the Section 54 approvals. Your role as shareholder representative, so you're both a shareholder and you are the minister, when you give those Section 54 approvals, and this would probably be under Section 54.2D that speaks about an acquisition or disposal of a significant asset, I think it must be of concern to all of us, yourself included, concerning the allegations of locomotive contracts and the role that Mr. Iqbal Sharma is alleged to have played. And you referred briefly to that issue relating to the 100 urgent locomotives. And there's correspondence that's been, again, leaked relating to letters by Mr. Iqbal Sharma that seem to be consciously removing a contract from a Japanese company to ensure that South China Rail received that contract. Now again, you've emphasized that you can't get involved in that, but purely because of the size of the contract, the initial 100 and then the other 1,000, that you would have had to give approval of Section 54. What I'm trying to understand is your role, and I think you've sketched it as a policy role, but surely there must be a deeper manner of oversight, both from your side and I think from our side as Parliament, when it comes to the approval, because that is probably one of the biggest contracts entered in the history of our country when it came to the locomotives. And we now know of Tequestra, and I'd urge you, just for your interest sake, to read those contracts that were signed between Tequestra and South China Rail. And myself, as a lawyer, I found it outrageous that there is a 21% commission fee built into that. And all they had to do to that was, there's a clause that says the company, CSR, will not require any proof of the delivery of services that Tequestra was supposed to provide, as it is understood that the project would not have materialized without the active efforts of Tequestra to provide the services listed above. So that is a bribery. It's a straightforward bribery. And I'm sure that in due course, the law enforcement agencies will investigate that further. But in view of the fact of your Section 54 approval, but the fact that this is an ongoing contract, so every month when those locomotives are being delivered, we seem to be paying 10 million rand more, and that's going to kickbacks.
You know, honourable members, I think what, at the end of this inquiry, the committee needs to advise on how should members of the executive, without compromising themselves, get involved in contracts of this nature and size as they are happening, not after the fact. Because the problem arises in that, having sparred with the Honorable Mazwan, Mazwani, sorry, earlier, having exchanged views and discussions with her earlier, and given the questions you are asking, I think the committee must advise on how members of the executive should engage with contracts of this nature and size as they are happening, not post the fact, because as I say, when you engage with this based on the annual report, there is nothing you can change. But the risk is still on you as the minister, because the question will be raised, why didn't you know? Couldn't you have done better? But the PFMA does not allow you to get to that level of detail as the contracts are taking place, because as I say, any member of the executive would say, what is the risk of my involvement now? If I involve myself and I ask these questions now, who are the bidders? Who are shortlisted? Who are being preferred? The question would be, why are you interested in this matter and not others? But it's a conundrum that we all need to solve collectively.
Could I then, just to conclude, ask you, should it not be a consideration as a shareholder representative to start look at holding directors to boards that you might have appointed liable in terms of PFMA lacks or offences, such as was highlighted in the Public Protector's report? And then secondly, in particular, to have directors declared delinquent directors under Section 162 of the Companies Act. I don't think that any shareholder representative has ever made use of that provision, where we clearly see, and you yourself as Minister of Finance asked Mr. Anuj Singh to step down, and to me, and I'm sure my colleagues here, we would say, and I put it to him, that in my view you are a delinquent director for what you did at Eskom. Should we not have those declarations and applications brought so that such people do not do damage going forward? Yes, it's again, we need to act earlier, and I appreciate your comments about maybe we need to look at an amendment to Section 54 2D to make it more clearer what is the responsibilities of the executive in Section 54. But I would submit that there are certain avenues that can be used, such as breaches of the PFMA Act, and regrettably, to my knowledge, I think the only person that was ever charged under PFMA was Minister Gordhan for those concocted charges. So we obviously we've got good legislation, but it doesn't seem to be implemented. But I think there's also more than sufficient in terms of the Companies Act for breach of fiduciary duties and for declarations of delinquent directorships. And there is this provision of Section 218 where you can in fact institute civil action for damages to a company. And I would submit that in this case, some of the directors of Eskom and possibly Transnet, Mr. Malefe, Mr. Singh, could be held responsible in terms of the Companies Act. Section 218(2) says any person who contravenes any provision of this Act is liable to any other person, and that could be the shareholder, for any loss or damage suffered by that person. So there's a lot of laws that one can use, but I want to thank you from my side for assisting us today. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Fart. Honourable Dlamini.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Kigaba, you are a defender of Gupta naturalization, granting them of passports and ID numbers. But before we go there, let's start with you. There are allegations that you are not, your citizenship is questionable. So can you respond to this question? Where were you born and where was your father born?
Honorable member, I find your question quite peculiar. Extremely peculiar, offensive to my family, offensive to my father who is late, offensive to my mother, offensive to my father who was born at Nqabeni, Embonela, where my clan has lived for hundreds of years, where if you go now, you will find members of my clan living on the land that the fathers of our fathers have lived, lands which they left us, our home where the spirits of my grandfathers still live. It's an offense to my mother who was born as Ngolweni among the Dlaminis, where the families of her parents have lived for centuries. It's an offense to all of us. It's an offense to my identity. Now, having said all of that, because I think it behoves all of us as honorable members not to attack each other's identities for political point scoring and for cheap gain. If I attack your identity, you would be as offended as I am. So if you want to know my identity, I invite you to go to Enqabeni, Embonela. Speak to members of my family. They will tell you who I am. You don't even have to be told by me. They will tell you who I am. They will tell you why my name is Nkanyezi and where does it come from. Who is Nkanyezi among my family members? Having said all of that, I'm sure you will respect my right to respond to you as you asked your question. Having said all of that, you then, and I know what you are trying to do is to irritate me, and you will not succeed. The naturalization of the Gupta, I'm still going to that one.
I just wanted to deal with where you were born and where your father was born. I'm going to the Guptas. I'm not there, so don't rush. I'm still going to ask that question. My question was very simple, Chairperson. I said, where was he born? Where was his father born? I have not asked about the Gupta, so we must not go there. Relax, so we're still going there.
No, I think it arises from the comment you raised earlier on, although it was not a question. If you say it wasn't a question, but you made a comment that related to that.
Yeah, then we must respond to questions. That's why I said my question to you. I was very clear.
But if the witness feels that the comment needs a reply, I don't think we should prevent them from...
No problem. Let him reply to comments. Okay.
Yeah. Minister, the witness can go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Now, having raised the issue of the Gupta citizenship, I will deal with it in the comprehensive detail, because the Honorable Member makes an inaccurate assertion that I'm at the center of the naturalization of the Gupta family members. There are 62 Gupta people in South Africa with the Gupta family. Of those 62 people, there are 39 who hold permanent residence permits. There are 13 who hold naturalization, 9 of whom were naturalized between 2002 and 2006, and only 4 who were naturalized in 2015, and there are 10 children that were born in South Africa. So of those 9 that were naturalized between 2002 and 2006, when I was not Minister of Home Affairs, surely the Honorable Member would be well advised that being the majority, including those who got permanent residence permits prior to my appointment as Minister of Home Affairs, that doesn't place me at the center of the naturalization of the Gupta family members. That's one. Number two, the honorable member, the four that were naturalized in 2015, there were valid reasons why the department advised that we should do so. And the letter of the law was followed to the full extent, including at the end of the process, they being asked to renounce Indian citizenship. And one of the five applicants in 2015 refusing to renounce Indian citizenship, and therefore he remained not a South African. The four that were naturalized complied upon appeal. They had started applying for South African citizenship in 2013 when I was not Minister of Home Affairs. Their application was rejected in 2014. They appealed in 2015, and the department established a panel, as the Director General has indicated, in terms of which their citizenship application was then approved. If there was a malicious intent to grant them South African citizenship, regardless of what South African law stipulated, they would not have been asked at the end of the process to state, to renounce Indian citizenship, and upon one member refusing to renounce it and was not granted South African citizenship and is not a South African citizen as we speak today, that member would have gone on to be granted South African citizenship regardless of what the law says. But that is not the case, it was not the case, which means that we followed the letter of the law to its full extent and did nothing outside it. The honorable member then says we granted them South African passports, and I'm sure he is referring to a passport which was circulating on social media relating to 2015. The said person to whom the honorable member is referring was granted his first passport. Now, a passport is a document you get. Now, there are two conditions to a passport.
I want the minister, he's saying I'm referring to a member. He can just say the name of that person that I'm referring to.
Okay.
The person that the honorable member is referring to, I was still explaining a passport. A passport can expire after 10 years, or once its pages get full, you then have to change it. So a person, if you look at my passport, which was issued in 2017 when I became, let's take my official passport, my diplomatic passport, which was issued in 2017 when I became Minister of Finance, it will not be the first diplomatic passport I have held in my life. The first diplomatic passport issued to me was issued in 2004 when I became Deputy Minister of Home Affairs. When I became Minister of Public Enterprises, I was issued with a new diplomatic passport, and so on and so on. So the person that the honorable member is referring to was issued his first passport in 2012 when I was not Minister of Home Affairs. So it was not the first time in 2015 that this person got a South African passport. The first passport he received was in 2012, and in that year I was not Minister of Home Affairs. And by law, because he had been naturalized in 2002, prior to me even being an MP, it means this person already qualified to hold the South African passport. Thank you.
You are saying that when I ask questions, you get offended. Let me tell you now, I don't care about that. You can get offended as much as you want. I'm going to ask you questions and you're going to provide answers. So that doesn't bother me. Now, I've never spoken about any member of the Gupta family, but you've decided to do that. Now, let me ask you a question. Atu Kumar Gupta, does he have South African citizenship?
Well, the Honourable Member, much as he feels he doesn't care about whether I'm offended or not, neither do I care, Honourable Member, whether you try to offend me or not. So it's okay. It's a draw. You did ask, you expressly asked, you said I'm at the center of the naturalization of the Gupta family. So you can contradict yourself now if you choose so, if it's convenient. But that being the case, yes, Atul Kumar Gupta is a South African citizen, naturalized in 2002. He was naturalized in 2002 when I was not even a member of parliament.
Rajesh Tony Gupta.
Rajesh Tony Gupta was naturalized, I think, in 2006.
AJ Gupta.
AJ Gupta is not a naturalized South African citizen. He holds a permanent residence permit only because he refused to renounce Indian citizenship, and therefore he's not a South African citizen.
Does AJ Gupta have a South African passport?
I don't know. I will have to check that. But holders of permanent residence permits are not issued with South African passport documents.
The press conference that you did dealing with the same issue of Gupta naturalization, there's a guy, his name is Mahlomo Chwete, apparently he's a spokesperson. He's saying you conducted that interview at your personal capacity. The press briefing at your personal capacity. Is that correct?
He was inaccurately quoted. He did not make any such claims because the media briefing was organized immediately after we went to brief the Home Affairs Portfolio Committee on the quarterly reports of the department, GPW and the IEC. Prior to the presentation of those quarterly reports, the chairperson advised that the committee should ask me questions around this issue, to which I responded, and there was a media briefing afterwards, at which, as I indicated subsequently, I erroneously made reference to Mr. Atul. I erroneously referred to Mr. Atul Gupta as not a South African citizen. I corrected that immediately that afternoon, and the following day I issued the statement because I had been advised by one of the officials to that effect, and I made mention of the fact without verifying with the Director General. And Mr. Mahlomo Chwete has subsequently reported the matter to the press ombudsman that he was being misrepresented.
You mentioned of the, when I spoke about issues relating to your family, you got offended. We dealt with that issue. And you would understand that part of what we're dealing with the state capture, it's got a lot to do with the influence of politicians, family members getting involved in the procurement and given tenders, boyfriends, stepdaughters, everything. We've been on this committee. We've been given that information, that this boyfriend, girlfriend, stepdaughter, everything. So the families are not immune to the issue that we are dealing with. Your wife, on the ENC interview, she said she helped with the IT system of Home Affairs as well as processing of passports. Is that correct? Is that how we operate?
It's not true. My wife at that interview was being asked about her own background, her own work. My wife has never, does not, will never, would never even interface with the work of any department at which I am deployed. Where she was working before, if there were matters that related to that company bidding for contracts at the Department of Home Affairs, those, she was never involved, and she has since stopped working for that company. But my wife has never, does not, will never, would never be involved in the internal affairs of the department in which I am working.
The fireblade approval, it went to court. I tried to follow the explanation. It went to court on the basis of the minutes of a meeting that you gave them the approval. And then it went to court various times up until the last judgment of the Constitutional Court. Can you give us that explanation again? Because the Constitutional Court has given a judgment on the appeal that you've made, that actually they've dismissed the appeal, to confirm that the minutes of that meeting were accurate.
Again, the Honourable Member is probably hasn't read what the Constitutional Court ruled. The Constitutional Court ruling says, we are dismissing your direct appeal to us on the basis that it is not yet ripe to serve before the Constitutional Court because you yourself have appealed to the Supreme Court of Appeal to overturn the decision of October and December last year at the High Court. So it's not rejected on the basis that there is a minute somewhere. It's only because there is an appeal pending with the Supreme Court, and only after that appeal, should we wish to pursue the matter with the Constitutional Court, then we can go ahead and do so. Then the Constitutional Court would consider the matter right to serve before it. But the minute that is being referred to is a minute which, as I said earlier, emanated from one party to the meeting. The minutes of meetings with government are not taken by non-government officials, and therefore you cannot take that minute to be binding until we all have agreed that this minute as is presented, we are prepared to sign on to it and have the matter resolved in that way. In this instance, we did not sign to any minute. And so it's a minute that only emanates from one of the parties, not both of them.
The removal of the ESCOM board members, you say you removed some of the board members and you left Barnard and Metomakul. The others, you removed them on the basis that they've served a long time within the board. So you felt that you must remove. Why did you retain Barnard and Metomakul? What was your reason?
It was to ensure continuity so that there is no gap between the new members and the old members. But secondly, if I'm not mistaken, they had not had the same duration on the board as the other members who were being removed.
You say you removed others because of the duration, the long duration. These two, is that the reason that you, that because remember you are under oath, so we can't be sitting with assumptions. Is that the reason why you retain these two? And what does, maybe when you answer that, what does governance oversight on the overalls of SOE says with the removal of the board members? Does it say to you, this one has served such a long time, we must remove them? Can you clarify that? What does it say?
The Honourable Member will remember that in my presentation I referred to a number of policies and guidelines and legislation including the King III and so on. Now, I said that there are conditions on which a member can and must serve on a board of a company, that when you have exceeded in many instances, when you have exceeded two terms, when you have served two terms on a board, depending on the MOI of a particular state-owned entity, you then have to be retired to allow for new appointments. I mean, you have to be rotated to allow for new appointments in order to regularly replenish the boards with new members. Once you have served longer than 9 years, it creates a problem of in regards to your independence and your proximity to the company in which you are serving. That is why one of the rules that I established at DPE was that instead of 3 years, instead of three terms, it should be two terms. That no member should serve in any board for a period longer than two terms of 3 years each. And that is the reason why in the case of the report of the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors last year, I supported it and signed to it, because I was saying for any audit firm to have a contract that lasts up to 120 years, it undermines independence of audit firms, of independent auditors, the audit committees, and even financial directors. So in this regard of ESCOM, this was the main reason, and that is why I stated that we then took the decision to change the board to allow for new members to come in. Among others, I was dealing with a particular challenge at that time, that the chairman of the board had been for some time an executive chairman, and that created a problem of distance between the role of CEO and the role of CFO. Now, the problem that arises here, that the committee, I'm sure, in the near future is going to deal with, is that the shareholder there has been no shareholder management legislation that guides how the shareholder should manage the state-owned companies. That bill is going to be brought before Parliament, hopefully during the course of this year, and it will allow Parliament to have an overarching legislation that guides the management of state-owned companies by the shareholder. At the present moment, you have a situation where the shareholders have got different shareholder departments, have got different shareholder guidelines and rules, different memoranda of incorporation, different shareholder compacts, and different ways of managing state-owned companies. The shareholder management legislation is going to put an end to all of that and ensure that there is common practice, best practice, that can be followed right throughout the country in managing state-owned companies.
Page 15 of your statement, you are saying if people we appointed want to do wrong things later, we cannot be held accountable. What do you mean that the people that you appointed, when they do wrong things, we can't hold you accountable?
Because, as I kept on explaining, it was never an intention to appoint someone who is going to do something wrong, one. Two, should anyone of the people be found to have done anything wrong, they themselves should be held accountable for what they did wrong, because they would not have acted on the mandate of the cabinet when it approved their appointment, and on behalf of the minister when the minister appointed them.
So, Mr. Kigabo, we are dealing with ESCOM issues here, with over 41,000 jobs at risk on the basis of the appointments that were approved by ministers. So are you saying to us, are you saying to the nation that if you are a minister and you appoint people in the board that have collapsed a state-owned entity simply because you didn't know when you were appointing them, you must not be held accountable? Is that what you are saying?
Absolutely. Because you would not have known that they were going to act in a particular way at a particular time. when you deal with hindsight, hindsight is what you know now, which you did not know back then when you took the decision. When new facts arise, that's what it's all about.
So you're saying those board members and executives, they must just, only themselves who must be accountable. Not the ministers. The ministers, they must be left alone, continue with their life as nothing happened. Is that what you're saying?
Because you deal with the person who did a wrong, not a person who appointed someone who did a wrong, when they did not know that someone was going to do a wrong.
So you are happy with the ministers that have, under their own portfolios, they've got departments that have collapsed through their own appointments. I'm not talking of people that were appointed that when you are not a minister. So you are saying those ministers are doing a good job, let life continue. South Africans, let us be happy. Let Minister Kigaba, Minister Lynn Brown, and everyone continue with their job, because they appointed those people, and those people have made to account, by the way. From the board chairpersons, they've been fired, the CEOs have been fired, but the ministers, it's all well and good.
You need to prove that a particular minister knew that a wrong was taking place and was complicit in the doing of the wrong.
So until it's not proven, as long as it has been proved by even removing the post that you appointed, you are saying, not you, you are fired, life must go. That's what I want to get from you.
I say anybody is presumed innocent until proven otherwise. The fact that someone appointed a board that eventually did something wrong does not necessarily make them liable. Of course they will come to answer. Of course they must be made to account. Of course they must answer for whether they knew, whether that was the purpose of the mandate which they gave to a particular board. And you must act on the basis of fact before you, not on the basis of what you wish to be the fact.
Okay, let me ask this question this way. A minister who presides over a department that has collapsed, that person you're saying must continue to be made a minister on other departments?
No, I'm not saying that. We are now talking about something different.
But you're saying they must not account. Accountability, it means accountability. Part of accountability, it means you can't be moved to another ministry. You were given a ministry and it collapsed. So do you say, in your own opinion, that minister is fine to be moved to another ministry? Because accountability, that's what it means. That even if it's not an issue of whether you find guilty or not, it's an issue that you presided over a department that has collapsed. Part of accountability, it means you can't be moved to another minister. So you are saying, no, it's fine, preside over a department that has been collapsed, because you are not found guilty of anything, it's fine to be moved to another ministry.
You must prove that the minister, remember, you must separate between the role of the minister as an executive authority and the role of the accounting office. You must prove that the minister directly contributed to the department collapsing. Once you prove that, you can then take that decision. But unless you have proven that, you can't arrive at that conclusion, because you are now acting on the basis of your wishes rather than on the basis of facts available before you.
Ministers of the ANC government. Mr. Iqbal Sharma, the cabinet rejected his appointment as chair. Did they give you the reason why they rejected that appointment?
Among others, it was that he had recently been a government employee as a DDG and head of the Trade and Investment South Africa, that it was because I think he stepped down from that role in 2010, if I'm not mistaken, 2009 or 2010, and that because of that, it was too early to make him a chair of the Transnet board. And secondly, that Mr. Mkhwanazi had only been appointed for less than a year, and so it would not be appropriate and would not be read correctly if he was then, if we then accepted his retirement from the board of Transnet. And Cabinet felt that the issues which seemed to be a concern with regard to him having been the CEO of Transnet and now being the chairman, and the challenge of separating the roles based on the experience, Cabinet felt that those issues could be resolved. And indeed, we went on to resolve those issues, and as we now know, Mr. Mkhwanazi served the board of Transnet until he was rotated, I think in 2014 or 2015. So those were the reasons. But Cabinet felt that because, one, of Mr. Sharma's experience at DTI, he needed to serve on the board or as a non-executive director of Transnet, and secondly, that because of the direction we were taking in terms of trying to establish some of our state-owned companies as national champions, that would play a leading role in investing in plant technology and skills both in the country and offshore, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, that would play a catalyzing role in driving transformation and industrialization, and ensure that they influence their customers and suppliers to transform, to also invest in local sectors. Cabinet felt that he would be an important skill to have on the board that would bring that government perspective and the DTI perspective onto the program that we were setting for particularly Transnet, DNEL, Eskom, and some of those state-owned companies.
On page 17 of your statement, you say you were advised to replace Mr. Mkhwanazi by Mr. Iqbal Sharma. Who advised you?
As I kept saying throughout the document, the advice would come from the department based on submissions presented to me, having the department having considered a number of facts before them. Sometimes I would agree with the advice, sometimes I would not agree, but I would trust the advice of the experts.
The appointment of Sharma as an NED, how did that come about? Who advised you on that one?
As I just said, Honorable Member, the advice would emanate from the department. They would have looked at a variety of skills required. They would do a skills audit, look at the variety of skills required, look at how those skills would assist us to balance between the corporate commercial as well as the developmental mandates of state-owned companies, and would select from the database available people who would possess the types of skill sets we required in order to meet those objectives.
Okay, maybe let me ask this question this way. The position of NED within the Transnet system, when did it become available?
It was available prior to my appointment, prior to even me becoming a minister. The board members are actually non-executive directors.
So there is no link that the board rejects Iqbal Sharma on being a chairperson and then he moves to be a non-executive director?
A chairperson of the board, Honorable Member, is a non-executive director. In all our state-owned companies, chairpersons of boards are non-executive directors. You do not get appointed first as chairperson of the board, then as a non-executive director. The process is otherwise. You get appointed as a non-executive director and then as a chairperson of the board. That is why Cabinet, in saying no, Mr. Sharma should not become the chairperson of the board, said, but we still support him as a non-executive director.
Mr. Molefe, as a CFO of Eskom, instead of Mr. Sehole, again, you are advised by the department that you must appoint Ms. Molefe. But also you are saying that Ms. Molefe's name appeared to be one of the top names that were recommended. How many other names were there, and how many that were females?
What the board would do is to submit three names which they recommend from which the minister can choose, from whom the minister can choose. Now, ideally, the minister would choose the top candidate because that would be the preferred candidate of the board. But there could be very valid reasons why the preferred candidate is not suitable and the minister chooses the next suitable candidate to become, to occupy the post that is being presented. In this instance, as I indicated extensively in my submission, there were valid reasons why Mr. Sehule would not have been suitable as a financial director at Eskom, and there were valid reasons why Ms. Molefe became a suitable candidate as the financial director, and I think the facts of her suitability prove her out.
Now, on the list, I'm asking you how many on the top list that were females. Was she the only one?
Was the only one.
You mentioning that Mr. Sehole had an issue of working in a political environment. Did Ms. Molefe had no issue with that?
She had no issue with it because she was already working for Eskom, which is a state-owned company whose shareholder is a political entity called government.
What were the specific reasons that Mr. Sehole outlined as his concerns working in a political environment?
I did not probe those reasons. I considered the submission presented before me and did not feel it was necessary for me to conduct another interview on top of the one that the board had already conducted.
Lastly, you say in a statement you were upset about the TMAUH breakfast because of the huge amounts that were there. But you want to participate in the same TMA breakfast yourself. So you get upset and then tomorrow or the other day you go and participate. How did that happen? Because you were already upset about it.
I was upset about the contracts that were being entered into. But what created the dilemma for many state-owned companies and what made many ministers to participate in the TNA, in the SABC TNA programs, was the fact that the public broadcaster was involved, and this provided an opportunity for government to outline its programs unmitigated for a substantial amount of time each morning.
Finally, you mentioned that you were invited to Gupta weddings, graduations, and everything. Did you go to the Gupta house in Sachsenwald for either invitation or anything? Have you ever been to that house?
The Diwali celebrations, the few Diwali celebrations that I attended were at the residence. And I went there, but they were few, as I say, and I subsequently stopped attending them. Especially when I decided that I'm going to stop attending events invited, where you are invited at people's residences, at people's private residences, because it does tend to create a public problem.
Thank you very much. We request that members of the inquiry and including the advocate, the witness, together with his legal team, move swiftly after I've concluded this announcement to grab something to eat, because we have a time constraint, so that we allow other guests to have something to have for lunch. We are requesting this because members, 20 minutes is not a long time, and there are a number of us in the room, so that we are able to come back, because we are already eating on a house sitting time. So we'd like us to resume shortly after 20 minutes. The time now is 14:05. Can we do, shall we? Thank you very much. We'll be back after 20 minutes. Resume after 20 minutes. Thank you.
say we must attack now.
Can I use the bottom quickly? Yeah?
Do you have a question like that?
Thank you.
Can we prepare ourselves back to our seats? We are left with only 2 minutes to resume our work. Thank you, Honourable Members. We are going to start our work again. We will start with Honourable Luyenge.
HB state-owned companies to probe the possibility of making the shareholder compact or the strategic intent statement public and to submit it to the portfolio committee for reference and noting, especially given the KPIs. When I became Minister of Public Enterprises, one of the difficulties, especially with the big SOCs, was that they often hardly met their shareholder compacts or their KPIs. And yet, they would go on and receive bonuses and all sorts of things, and people would find interesting, sophisticated ways to explain why they needed to get the bonuses. And one of the things that I proposed was that we consider reviewing either the long-term incentives or the short-term incentives, because they tended to make the remuneration of senior executives to be larger than was publicly acceptable. But on the other hand, the KPIs were not met, and sometimes they would set themselves low KPIs which they would easily meet. If you take, for example, the crane moves per hour at the Durban port, or the on-time departures and on-time arrivals by the trains on your Richards Bay Coal Line, you would have in many instances late departures, late arrivals. Sometimes by the time a train arrives at the Richards Bay Coal Terminal, the ship that they were supposed to load would have left, or it would have been delayed, and now the coal supplier would be charged for the delays right through the value chain, and all because of inefficiencies at Transnet. And the crane moves per hour, Transnet was underperforming all its peers. And at the time, countries like Singapore and others were overperforming. Now, we dealt with this, and it wasn't merely an issue of technology, even though the introduction of new cranes in Durban helped a lot, and as well as in PE, helped a lot in improving the crane moves. But it was largely a management function, the inability to manage the people who are operating at the ports. And I said to them, I want the country, I don't want to be the only one who knows about your KPIs. I want the portfolio committee to also know, and I want the country to also know. What are your KPIs? We were experiencing delays in all the major build programs at Medupi, Kusile, and Ingula, in addition to which you were having freak accidents at Ingula. You were having recurrent strikes at Medupi. There was no ability on the part of Eskom to manage these contracts, and the capital project management skills were not available, and the company had not established that specialized function on its executive. And so there wasn't anybody who was particularly responsible for the management of such big capital projects. So that was the context. And really, I still believe the KPIs of an SOE which operates as a natural monopoly must not be must not be confidential. I think they should be public. I think the Portfolio Committee needs to know. It would help, because the problem with such state-owned companies, which are natural monopolies, is that they become arrogant in how they treat their suppliers, how they treat their customers, and even in how they relate with the shareholder. They choose which information to share that is going to result in positive benefits for the company. Now, so surely, as I was arguing with them, we needed to change that to ensure that the Portfolio Committee, we make these things public, they post it on their website so that everybody knows. If I'm an iron ore miner, I should know what are your KPIs on your Sishen Saldanha iron ore route. If I'm a coal miner and I export coal, I need to know what are your KPIs in relation to my own area of work. So it was my intention, and I did engage the boards with regard to making either the shareholder compact available to the Portfolio Committee and the public, or at least the KPIs available. Obviously, the corporate plan can't be made public because it contains market-sensitive information. But the KPIs are something that should be made public. The board tender committee is a board subcommittee. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's made up of politicians, because board members are supposed to be independent non-executive directors. And their job is not to play politics with the company. Their job is to provide governance oversight over the company on behalf of the shareholder and to account to the shareholder through regulated means. It is an issue we need to discuss very carefully. What is the administrative role of the minister? Now, it's different in the department, because in the department, the line of accountability is much more simpler, much more clarified. From the minister, there is a DG, there are DDGs, you know, the line functions. In an SOE, where there is a board, which is an accounting officer, it's a governance structure, there is a CEO who is an accounting officer, at what point should the minister get involved? I really would be wary as a minister to even be invited to sit and discuss tenders in the company, even if I was invited by the board itself, unless the board is saying to me, "Minister, we want to report to you about irregularities that we have found in relation to certain contracts and tenders." And that's a different matter. But where they are still making decisions, to involve the minister is to expose someone who should stay away from this process. And so my view would be, in considering the shareholder management bill and whether any changes must be introduced in the PFMA, obviously in consultation with the National Treasurer and Cabinet as a whole, the committee may want to make suggestions about what should we do to curb a recurrence of some of the problems that we have experienced over the years. With regards to the lenders, you know, it's a simple thing, I think, in my opinion. You take a loan. You have a credit card. Basically, it's a loan. It's not money you have. It's money the bank lends to you. You use it, you accumulate, and then the bank says to you, "Hey, Chief, we had given you a credit line of this much. You've exceeded it. We now have to get our money back." Now they start imposing conditions. we think you are not managing your finances well. When I was young in the ANC Youth League, we had a friend. He had a credit card. And this friend who had a credit card, his credit card would buy all sorts of things, largely alcohol. And there was an old man who was at Nedbank in Johannesburg. I forgot the street of the street of that bank where we were banking. He would call us and say, "Hey, you know, tell your friend to stop buying alcohol every weekend, man. He's blowing up his account, and now we have to impose conditions on him." That's basically what the lenders would do. They've lent you the money. You've accumulated a debt, or you've misused the credit line. They now impose conditions. It's not capture. They are now acting in their own interest, because if they don't control you, what is the risk of you not paying them back? They lose money, and they lose credibility, because the question they will have to account to the shareholders: why didn't you see on time that this person was failing to pay you back? I mean, that's the challenge we were facing with regard to SAA last year, with regard to Eskom, that the bill is growing. Even as we changed the board of SAA, the lenders still said to us, "You've done well, but not enough for us to lend to SAA." The same thing applied to Eskom. We had to strain ourselves to assist Eskom to raise the money they needed, otherwise they would not have been able to pay salaries by end of March. And that would have had such an effect on the company that it would have spilled over to the national fiscus. And as the national fiscus doesn't have capacity to pay back all the 258 billion rand guaranteed loan of Eskom. So that is the challenge. And I think not only in regard to state capture, but in regard to the commercial management of our state-owned companies, we need to improve their balance sheets and their financial sustainability so that they are able to keep the lenders at ease and still be able to raise money in the bond market. It became a problem towards the end of last year and beginning of this year that a number of our state-owned companies were no longer able to go to the financial sector to raise money. And that's the challenge that we need to address. DINEL, SA Express, SAA, Eskom itself. You need to ensure that they are financially stable so that they are able to pay back. Now, finally, on the former SAA chair, when I was appointed at finance, she approached me, or we met, at which meeting she presented me with reports, several reports of forensic investigation. They dealt with a wide variety of issues, and one of those was the issue of the suppliers and service providers to SAA. I met with the board that we changed and discussed this with them, and clearly they had not had time to properly process the report. But these were their own reports, and I said to them, there is a problem that in you failing to process your own report, your own forensic report, now that you know about irregularities alleged in there and other problems, you now are liable for criminal charges. And now that I myself know about this, I have to act. So we engaged with them. We then changed the board subsequently, and I tabled those reports to the new board, and they are dealing with them. The issue of transformation must not be sacrificed during all of these processes. going to be very important for this committee in terms of the work it's doing, to separate state capture from transformation and not to conflate the two.